On today's show and previous episodes of The Constituency can be found at kpfk.org/archives for 90 days and also at soundcloud.com/theconstituencykpfk.
Please consider making a secure donation online at kpfk.org. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, coming up next.
If you would like to support your favorite radio station, KPFK, please consider donating your vehicle to us, whether it's operational or not, because your donation helps KPFK as well as present you with an opportunity to write it off of your taxes. And if you would like to donate and get more information, please give us a call at 877-KPFK-AUTO. Once again, that's 877-KPFK-AUTO. Peace.
This is Al Franken, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara.
From the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, this is Democracy Now!
Trillions, not billions!
Climate justice activists are outraged at how little money is being offered here at this finance COP by the most polluting nations to countries most severely affected by climate change. We'll speak to a spokesperson with Brazil's Climate Observatory and the head of PowerShift Africa.
There's no point accepting a deal if it's going to result in the deaths of the climate vulnerable communities on the front lines of climate change. There's no point in accepting a deal if Baku is going to be the burial ground of 1.5 degrees.
Then to the International Criminal Court's historic decision to issue arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. We'll talk to leading Palestinian human rights attorney, Raji Sarani.
It's a great day to have these genociders finally with arrest warrant and wanted for justice at the most important court on earth.
Then to the so-called nonprofit killer bill that the U.S. House just passed. It could give the Trump administration sweeping power to revoke the tax-exempt status of any group, including media organizations.
It gives overreaching power to the administration, especially now the incoming Trump administration, to be able to shut down a nonprofit organization they may disagree with politically.
And we'll look at Trump's new pick for Attorney General Pam Bondi. As Florida Attorney General, she dropped a probe into Trump University after Trump donated $25,000 to her campaign. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan's delegation to the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit has released the latest draft of a climate financing deal calling for the delivery of $1.3 trillion per year by 2035. But the text only calls on wealthier, more polluting countries to pay $250 billion per year to poorer nations bearing the brunt of the crisis. The Group War on Want called the latest draft an insult, adding it's, quote, nowhere near the public grant-based climate finance the planet and people urgently need, unquote. Negotiations are expected to continue through the weekend. We'll have the latest from right here at COP29 after headlines. In Gaza, Israel's deadly attacks are continuing a day after the ICC issued historic arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. In North Gaza, the beleaguered Kamel Adwan Hospital warns it'll turn into a mass grave if no medical supplies are allowed in, as it remains besieged and under attack from Israeli forces. In Gaza City, rescuers searched the rubble today after at least 20 Palestinians, including children, were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a building housing displaced families.
This building has been hit three times, and every time people were massacred. Most of it was gone. Nobody was left. All of them are martyred today. A whole family lays here. A whole family has been wiped away. I swear to God, the whole family is wiped from the civil registry because of you, Israel. You kill civilians.
In southern Lebanon, an Israeli air attack has killed another two paramedics, adding to the more than 220 health workers who've been killed by Israel in Lebanon. Separately, an airstrike in Beirut's southern suburbs leveled at least one massive building earlier today. Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, a coalition of rights groups are suing the Dutch government for providing arms to Israel and failing to prevent genocide in Gaza. President-elect Trump has named his former impeachment lawyer, former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, as his new pick for Attorney General Thursday after Matt Gaetz withdrew from consideration. At least four Republican senators adamantly opposed Gaetz' confirmation amidst a firestorm over sexual misconduct and trafficking allegations. As Florida's top prosecutor, Pam Bondi led a failed campaign to overturn the Affordable Care Act and fought to uphold Florida's ban on same-sex marriage. She now works with the right-wing think tank America First Policy Institute. The news outlet The Lever reports Pam Bondi's brother, Brad Bondi, has represented Elon Musk and Tesla against federal securities fraud charges. We'll have more on the Trump nomination of Pam Bondi later in the broadcast. The U.S. House of Representatives on Thursday approved H.R. 9495, dubbed the nonprofit killer by civil society groups. The measure would give the incoming Trump administration broad authority to go after its critics by revoking the tax-exempt status of any group it labels a terrorist-supporting organization, with no evidence needed. The bill passed on a 219-184 vote, with 15 Democrats joining Republicans. H.R. 9495 has the support of the Anti-Defamation League and other Israel lobby groups. Critics warn the law would immediately target organizations fighting for Palestinian rights. The bill's fate in the Senate remains uncertain. We'll have more later in the broadcast. Brazil's federal police force has recommended criminal charges against far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro for attempting a coup as he attempted to cling to power in the wake of the 2022 presidential election. The recommended charges against Bolsonaro, along with 36 former aides and cabinet members, came as CNN Brazil reported Bolsonaro had full knowledge of a plot to assassinate then-president-elect Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Five people, including a former advisor to Bolsonaro, were arrested over the alleged conspiracy this week. On Thursday, President Lula spoke publicly about the plot for the first time.
I can assure you that I am a man who has much more to be thankful for because I am alive. The attempt to poison me and Vice President Ackman did not work, and we are still here.
The Kremlin has denied claims by Ukraine that Russia used an intercontinental ballistic missile in an attack on the central Ukrainian city of Dnipro. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the attack had instead used a new type of intermediate-range hypersonic ballistic missile carrying non-nuclear payloads. The Kremlin called the strike a warning to the United States and United Kingdom for allowing Ukraine to fire U.S. and British-made missiles at targets deep inside Russia. In Pakistan, at least 42 people were killed and more than a dozen critically injured Thursday when gunmen opened fire on a convoy of 200 vehicles traveling through a remote northwestern region near the Afghan border. Witnesses say about 10 assailants appeared to target Shia Muslims, first attacking a police escort before firing indiscriminately on buses and cars. It's the latest in a series of deadly sectarian clashes between majority Sunnis and minority Shias in Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa region that have killed dozens of people in recent months. Back in the United States, federal prosecutors in Brooklyn have indicted India's wealthiest man, Gautam Adani, and several associates on multiple counts of fraud under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, a U.S. anti-bribery law. Prosecutors accuse Adani of leading a $250 million bribery scheme in India to obtain solar energy contracts worth billions of dollars, then covered up the graft to raise money from U.S. and international investors. Adani, who's listed as the world's 19th richest person with a net worth of more than $85 billion, is a close ally of the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who has repeatedly helped Adani Group win lucrative government contracts. Over 200 New Yorkers, including activists, union members, and elected leaders, gathered to call on New York Governor Kathy Hochul and the New York Power Authority to build 15 gigawatts of renewable energy. New York has proposed building just 3.5 gigawatts of renewable energy. This is Delorney Mamoran of South Bronx Unite.
2025 is coming, and the world is literally on fire. Brush fires everywhere. The Bronx has the highest brush fires in the past 2 weeks. And we have a Democratic governor and a Democratic majority in Albany. This is not the time to slow down on reforms. 15 gigawatts is possible.
New York City Assembly member and mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani warned New York Governor Hochul is legally bound to fulfill New York's climate goals as laid out in the Build Public Renewables Act.
If you want to know how we can defeat the Donald Trump far-right movement, it's by showing that we actually have a workable alternative. Woo! Because if working class people can't breathe the air, if they can't afford to live in the city they call home because they can't find a union job, and if they look around at their favorite parts being on fire, why would they trust us?
In Kansas City, Missouri, community members are calling for accountability after a 34-year-old mother, Maria Pike, and her two-month-old daughter, Destiny Hope, were killed in an altercation with police where officers acknowledged they fired at least one shot. Their family members are demanding the release of body camera footage. And Palestinian-American poet Lina Khalaf Tufaha called on writers to use the power of words and their platforms to demand an end to genocide in Gaza as she accepted the National Book Award Wednesday for her poetry collection about Palestine called Something About Living.
I want us to feel and be uncomfortable and be disoriented and be angry and get up and demand that any administration, no matter what letter it has at the end of its name, D, R, whatever, that any administration that we pay for should stop funding and arming a genocide in Gaza.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I am Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. Today, Friday, is the final official day of COP29, but it's unclear if a final deal will be agreed upon by the deadline. Negotiations are expected to extend into the weekend. Climate justice activists are outraged at how little money is being offered here at this what's called the finance COP by the most polluting nations to the most severely affected by climate change. Azerbaijan's delegation to the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit has released the latest draft of a climate financing deal calling for the delivery of $1.3 trillion per year by 2035. But the text only calls on wealthier nations, more polluting countries, to pay $250 billion per year to poorer nations bearing the brunt of the crisis. The group War on Want called the latest draft an insult, adding it's, quote, nowhere near the public grant-based climate finance the planet and people urgently need, unquote. As the talks continue, we begin our coverage with climate justice activists and members of civil society who held a protest here calling for rich nations to pay up for climate finance. It was just before we went to broadcast. Democracy Now! Was there.
We are not demanding aid. We are not demanding charity. We are here to demand justice. And this justice comes through climate finance. How much do we want, comrades?
Trillions, not billions! Trillions, not billions! This is not charity. This is a debt, an obligation that the global north owes to the global south. It is a legal obligation, and we will not stop fighting until that obligation is met. We are demanding that this finance be public and high quality. This finance must be based on grants and grant-based equivalents, not on loans, not on things that further indebt the global south and continue this dangerous, deadly cycle. This finance must be high quality. It must also not be from the private sector, because the private sector are the ones who have helped drive this climate crisis, who have helped get us into this mess. We cannot rely on the same corporations, on the same rapacious banks who have driven the climate crisis, who are driven by profit, not by human rights and by justice.
What we are asking for is not unreasonable. They pump money into the fossil fuel industry. We know where the money is. We know where financing lies. And now to discuss further, I call on our comrade Rimsha.
No more debt, no more loans, no more false solutions.
No more debt, no more loans, no more false solutions.
My dear friends, I come here from a country where there is a lockdown going on. It's not COVID anymore, but my children, my women, and my youth are having a lockdown because of the air pollution that is being caused. And who is financing these climate crises? It's all the global north countries who are financing these. And we are still begging them for more loans to support our economic growth. They owe us. We don't owe them. They owe us.
They owe us. We don't owe
We've been told to keep it down, as if we aren't being piped down enough. Are we being loud?
No!
Are we being loud enough?
No!
Maybe we can give it one more chant, my comrades. Trillions, not billions! Trillions, not billions! Trillions, not billions! Trillions, not billions!
Trillions, not billions!
Just a few of the voices calling for rich nations to pay up for climate finance here at COP29. Yes, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit here in Baku, Azerbaijan. This year expected to be the hottest year on record. Negotiations at COP29, known as the Finance COP, are also very heated. The COP29 presidency has released new text for the finance part of the deal that calls for a finance target of $1.3 trillion by 2035, but only calls for wealthier and more polluting countries to pay $250 billion per year to poorer nations who bear the brunt of the crisis but are least responsible for it. Oil Change International calls the text an absolute embarrassment, saying it's the equivalent of handing the keys to the fire truck to the arsonists. Talks to reach a final agreement appear likely to extend past today, the final official day of the summit. We're joined now by two guests, Mohamed Addo, founding director of PowerShift Africa, which he formed in 2018 to mobilize climate action in Africa and shift climate and energy policies to zero carbon. He's based in Nairobi, Kenya. And we're joined from Brazil by Claudio Angelo. He's head of international policy at the Climate Observatory Civil Society Network in Brazil, which is a member of Climate Action Network Latin America. He's usually based in Brasilia, but joins us now here in Baku. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I mean, between you, you have almost 30 years of going to these COPs. Me and you, Mohamed, have been going since Copenhagen, and Claudio, you went even before that to Bali. Let's start with you, Mohamed. You have called this the worst COP ever. And for people to understand, COP stands for Conference of Parties. And you can explain why you think this is such a catastrophe here.
This is a worst COP in recent memory. COPs are usually very delicate and requires a lot of diplomacy to get countries to agree to tackle climate change, reduce emissions. But the agenda for this year's COP is to mobilize climate finance so that we can help developing countries who have contributed the least to the climate problem to be able to contribute to the global effort to tackle climate change, both by way of emissions reductions, but also to help them adapt to the inevitable impact of climate change and deal with the residual adverse impact of climate change. The presidency, instead of allowing an eye-to-eye negotiations between the parties, has actually been covering for the rich world and not forcing them to put forward figures. So the developing countries have called for $1.3 trillion per year to help them deal with climate change. Developing countries have been doing this from day one. And up to today, we haven't had a number in a text. Before I come to the number, the rich world have actually done everything to avoid to put forward a number. On the other hand, developing countries have been calling them to engage them in good faith and in a negotiation that allows us to actually have a compromise and a successful deal. Now, instead of facilitating a negotiation between parties, the presidency has done everything to avoid that and has actually given an excellent cover to the rich world. Of course, the responsibility is on the rich world, and the rich world have shirked their responsibility to provide climate finance. On the text that you've just referenced, the rich world are now required to provide $250 billion per year, but from 2035. Let's understand what this means. This is a 30% reduction from the $100 billion that they promised the developing countries once you account for inflation. So what they promised the developing countries is $100 billion per year from 2020. So they made that promise 15 years ago and failed to honor it. Now they're making another promise 10 years down the line in 2035. So once you actually factor a very conservative 5% inflation, that is a 70% reduction to the $100 billion. And it's just 20% of what developing countries have asked for. And so it's actually a slap in the face of developing countries and doesn't get us to where we need to be.
And what does it mean? What would the money be used for? Why does this, at this point, still possible to avert total catastrophe if the developing world can adapt, can deal with climate change, and the most polluting countries in the world, the U.S. historically, the greatest greenhouse gas emitter, phases out fossil fuels?
So what we need to be able to tackle climate change effectively is massive reductions in emissions and to also afford the vulnerable countries the opportunity to adapt to the inevitable impact of climate change and deal with loss and damage. Developing countries, out of an assessment that was done by the UN, have said they require at least $1.3 trillion per year to be able to contribute to the global effort to tackle climate change. What the rich world are now offering is just 20% of that, which effectively is a reduction of the promise they made 15 years ago. Now, if we're truly serious about emissions reductions, and if we're serious about providing solidarity to the vulnerable countries to be able to adapt, we should provide them the support that they require. There was a very objective independent needs determination report, and that report said developing countries require $1.3 trillion to be able to do that. We wouldn't expect the developing countries to provide 20% of the ambition that is needed. So why can't we provide them the money to help them do it? This is a great swindle, and we must call that out.
Talk about how climate change affects your country, Kenya, your continent, Africa, Mohammed.
So the continent of Africa is home to 18% of the global population and contributes less than 4% of emissions on an annual basis. But if you are to account for emissions from 1850, when we started emitting, the continent of Africa has contributed less than 0.5% of the historic emission. This is a continent that is also most vulnerable to climate change because of our geographic location, but also because of our low adaptive capacity. We're ravaged by extreme weather events. We're now paying for, you know, the harms that have been caused by the historic emissions by the rich world. And instead of providing us support, what the rich world is doing is actually telling us to pay for those harms so that we can be able to pay out of our own national budget without actually them paying for their liability. So you're vulnerable, you're least responsible, but you also have incredible potential to contribute to the global effort to tackle climate change. 60% of the renewable energy resources, especially solar, is in Africa. 40% of the critical minerals that are needed to help the world decarbonize are in Africa. But you know what? Africa attracts 2% of the total global renewable energy investment. So the continent, with 600 million people without electricity, a billion people without clean cooking, instead of the rich world providing them the support so that we can be able to develop in a climate-compatible manner, they are hoarding that and not sharing the resources, both by way of finance but also technology. Let's remember, we're in a climate negotiation. And climate justice has to guide us on how we respond to the climate crisis. Those with the broadest shoulders, who have emitted the bulk of the emissions and in the process accumulated a lot of wealth, in part by polluting without facing the cost of doing so, should shoulder the greatest burden.
Mohammed, you're following these very closely. What is the role of the United States?
So, United States is the biggest historic polluter. A third of the historic emissions have come from the U.S. And this is the wealthiest country that has the greatest financial and technological wherewithal. Instead of playing by the rule book, the U.S. is tearing it apart. They're not stepping up. They're not committing to sufficient emissions reductions. They're not providing finance. And using the excuse of Trump, the U.S., instead of helping the world arrive at a good deal, they're forcing the poor countries to accept a bad deal because of the fear of a Trump administration.
What do you mean, because of the fear of a Trump administration? What is? Well, John Podesta is the climate envoy. He followed John Kerry. What is the U.S. doing?
So, because of the threat of the Trump administration to pull out of the Paris Agreement, they want to force developing countries to actually compromise. They're holding developing countries hostage to accept a deal that is not good enough. And here we are, civil society, saying, instead of accepting a bad deal, a no deal is actually better. It's better to actually work towards a deal that meets the requirements of the world. There's no point accepting a climate finance goal if it's not going to add up to help us get the job done.
So, Mohammed Addo is from Kenya, and he's the director of PowerShift Africa. We're going to go to Brazil right now with Claudio Angelo. He's a former journalist, head of international policy at Climate Observatory, civil society network in Brazil, member of the Climate Action Network. Interestingly, next year, the COP30 will take place in Brazil, right on the edge of the rainforest. And you were just recently there in Benham. If you can talk about the state of these negotiations, because it's not done yet. I mean, we're sitting here on Friday late afternoon around 5 o'clock. Some say it might go till Monday, go till tomorrow. So the draft agreements can change based on how much people learn has been compromised, Claudio.
Yeah, this is likely drag way over time because the text as it is totally unacceptable right now. In fact, the text looks as if it was made on purpose for trolling purposes because it's obvious that no developing country could ever accept what is at the table right now. So it's likely that we will have a few more iterations of this text. And if we don't, or if the language doesn't change, this COP could end in a deadlock.
What is the position of President Lula of Brazil? I mean, we just interviewed the Colombian negotiator, Susana Mohammed. President Petro, interesting name for a climate summit, even though he's something like the sixth largest oil-producing nation in the world, is committing to phasing out fossil fuels. What about Lula?
Lula is pushing for massive expansion of fossil fuels in Brazil. One thing, however, is the situation within Brazil. And the other thing is the positions Brazilian diplomats are taking here, and they're actually being constructive. Brazil is willing to debate the implementation of the phase-out of fossil fuels provided for in the Dubai decision last year. Brazil even put that in the NDC, that it would welcome a debate for a calendar for phasing out of fossil fuels, as long, of course, rich countries go first. So we might expect to see some of that happening in Belém. We might even hope we'll have a calendar or at least a process aiming towards a calendar established at COP30. But as Brazilian diplomats have been saying here very clearly, before COP30, we have to sort out COP29. And COP29 right now is not going to a nice place.
Agriculture is an important sector in Brazil, with agribusiness making up something like half the country's exports. The sector also accounts for a quarter of Brazil's greenhouse gas emissions each year. How will this be addressed? And then talk about where we're headed next year, COP30, what it means to be in the Amazon rainforest.
Right. Well, if you look at Brazil's emissions curve, the agribusiness activities, if you account for deforestation, it's actually 75% of our emissions every year, because 46% of Brazilian emissions are just deforestation, most of it in the Amazon and in the Cerrado, the central Brazilian savanna. So agriculture is tremendously important for Brazil. I wouldn't expect COP30 to be a COP about agriculture or about forests. It's going to be a climate conference in the Amazon, not necessarily about the Amazon. Of course, Brazil has its own ideas about how to handle money for forest conservation and for reducing deforestation. It's actually doing a good job on tackling deforestation right now in the Lula administration. But COP30 should really be about the elephant in the room, and that's fossil fuels.
Well, we're going to continue to cover this on Monday, even when we're not here. Not clear if it will be over by the time of our broadcast then. But I wanted to ask you one more question about Brazil's federal police force recommending criminal charges against the far-right former president, Jair Bolsonaro, for attempting a coup as he tried to cling to power in the wake of the 2022 presidential election. The recommended charges against Bolsonaro, along with 36 former aides and cabinet members, came as CNN Brazil reported Bolsonaro had full knowledge of a plot to assassinate then-president-elect Lula. Five people, including a former advisor to Bolsonaro, were arrested over the alleged conspiracy this week. This is what President Lula said about the plot for the first time.
I can assure you that I am a man who has much more to be thankful for because I am alive. The attempt to poison me and Vice President Ackman did not work, and we are still here.
As we wrap up, Claudio, the significance of this, of the former president, the allegations that he was involved with the coup and had knowledge of the attempted assassination.
Well, the indiction of Bolsonaro and some of his former aides is, of course, very serious. But I'll spare my celebration for when he's in jail.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but continue, of course, to cover all of these issues. Claudio Angelo is head of international policy at Brazil's Climate Observatory. He's based in Brasilia, usually. Mohamed Adel is director of Power Shift Africa, based in Nairobi, Kenya. But we're all here in Baku, Azerbaijan, for COP29, the UN Climate Summit that's being held here. When we come back, we speak to the leading Palestinian human rights attorney, Raji Sarani, about the International Criminal Court's historic decision to issue arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant. Back in 20 seconds.
My people of the world, come let us stand in solidarity. As the world is in crisis, from the loss and the damage the whole world is going through. Wealthy nations are failing to act. They cannot fulfill a promise. As the years they go by, people and they die. It's a call for one action. Our world is crushing, our world is dying. Tell me who is gonna save us from the loss and the damage. Our world is crushing, our people are dying. Tell me who is gonna save us from the loss and the damage. Tell me who's gonna save our world. We are facing the struggle. Industrialization from the rich nations is the cause of our trouble.
Tell us who by Climate Action Network International. Those are protesters here, climate justice activists, leaders in the climate community, dancing. They're not allowed to make a lot of noise at the climate summit. Yes, we're in Baku, Azerbaijan for the UN Climate Summit COP29. I'm Amy Goodman. But we're turning now to the International Criminal Court's historic decision to indict Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as Hamas commander Mohammed Deif. In a statement, the ICC said the Israeli leaders had intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival, including food, water, and medicine and medical supplies, as well as fuel and electricity, unquote. On Thursday, Netanyahu slammed the International Criminal Court for making what he called an anti-Semitic decision, unquote. The Biden administration also criticized the ICC. This is White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre.
We fundamentally reject the court's decision to issue arrest warrants for senior Israel officials. We remain deeply concerned by the prosecutor's rush to seek arrest warrants and the troubling process errors that led to this decision. The United States has been clear that the ICC does not have jurisdiction over this matter.
But other nations, including Italy, the Netherlands, and Canada, have vowed to comply with the ICC arrest warrants. On Thursday, Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to Raji Sarani, the founder and director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza. The award-winning human rights lawyer fled Gaza after Israel bombed his home. He is the winner of the Right Livelihood Award, as well as the Robert F. Kennedy International Human Rights Prize. He spoke to us from Cairo, Egypt. I asked him to respond to the International Criminal Court ruling.
This is a great day for justice and dignity of man. It's a great day for the rule of law. And this day makes us remember all these souls of children, women, civilians, all the destruction, all the starvation and displacements. Mm-hmm. Gaza suffered for the last 13 months in this ongoing genocide, which broadcasted live on air at the real time to the whole world and costed us so far. 44,000 has been killed. More than 70% of them are civilians. And not only that, but 140,000 has been injured. One third of them will die because there is no access for medical equipment or medicine or even food. So it's a great day to have these genociders finally with arrest warrant and wanted for justice at the most important court on earth.
Well, Raji Sarani, could you respond to the way that the Israeli prime minister has responded to this news? The prime minister's office declared in a statement on Thursday that the ICC's anti-Semitic decision to issue arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant is, quote, equivalent to a modern Dreyfus trial. Your response, Raji Sarani?
I mean, no new news in this. They are very arrogant. They are very jealous. The West, especially U.S. and Europe, made Israel feel they will never, ever, they will be held accountable. They feel they are immune. They are doing all what they are doing at the daylight, and they don't hide it. They attack children cancer hospitals at the daylight. They attack hospitals and doctors. They rape prisoners by the army and the army detention centers. They kill women, children at the daylight. They starve people. They criminalize UNRWA. The body which should serve the Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip. The only body which is doing and delivering that. And nobody holds them accountable. Look, last night, this ugly veto of the U.S. to the Security Council against ceasefire just to stop genocide. By whom we are killed? By which bombs and missiles and airplanes? It's American. It's European. They feel they are fully immune. They are free to do whatever they can. They will never be held accountable. And why their appetite for crimes going like a snowball every day, like now they are talking publicly. We're cleaning Gaza from this 2.5 million people, and we will settle in it, and the settlers will be there. And they began to sell the land of Gaza to the settlers and to sell the apartments. And they declared their intention about West Bank and the cleaning. This is unprecedented that such state, Israel, having all these crimes were crimes against humanity and genocide, and just be dealt normally. This criminal, while he's doing genocide, he came to the Congress and he was received by everybody, and everybody was applauding him and his acts more than the president of the United States. So he's a criminal. He deserves accountability.
That's Raji Sarani, founder and director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, where he was born. The award-winning human rights lawyer fled Gaza after Israel bombed his home last year. To see the full interview, go to democracynow.org. Raji was speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Baku, Azerbaijan. But we're looking at a bill that was passed in the House of Representatives Thursday. It was approved. It would empower the Treasury Department to revoke the tax-exempt status of any nonprofit it deems to have provided material support to a terrorist organization without any evidence needed. If the bill becomes law, it could apply to a range of nonprofits, including unions, membership organizations, foundations, and media organizations. A broad coalition of civil society groups have opposed the so-called nonprofit killer. H.R. 9495 passed the House 219 to 184, with 15 Democrats supporting the Republican majority. Earlier versions of the bill received broad bipartisan support, but following Donald Trump's election, most Democrats withdrew their support. For more, we go to East Lansing, Michigan, where we're joined by Dara Lee. He's an anthropologist, lawyer, and legal scholar teaching at the University of Chicago. His analysis of the so-called nonprofit killer bill was published on Spencer Ackerman's blog, ForeverWars.com. It's headlined the most dangerous domestic anti-terrorism bill since the Patriot Act. Okay, Daryl, why? Why is this so significant? Again, it was passed in the House. It now makes its way to the Senate.
Thank you for having me on, Amy. As you mentioned, this bill is essentially a civil rights disaster that would allow the government under any administration. I want to be clear that this bill is terrible no matter who is president, but it would allow the government to shut down nonprofits on the smear of being terrorist supporting organizations. Now, obviously, the government, after decades of authoritarian war on terror policies, already has ample legal tools at its disposal to go after nonprofits essentially for any reason that it wishes. What this bill would do, in addition, the thing that it would add and the thing that makes it so dangerous, and actually the most dangerous domestic terrorism law in a generation, is that it would essentially smuggle in through the back door a domestic terrorist group list for the first time. This is something that the United States to this day still doesn't have. We have many, many lists of so-called foreign terrorist organizations that are overwhelmingly Muslim and or based in the global South. This law requires an accusation with no evidence, but a tie-in. It's an accusation that nonprofits are supporting a group on one of the existing international terrorism lists. This is important to understand because it explains why so many people on the right in Congress are comfortable signing on, because the bill is essentially discriminatory by design. Right-wingers and white supremacists in Congress can support this bill with the assurance that their allies, right-wing extremist groups, are highly, highly unlikely to ever be targeted by this bill, because it's much less likely that they will be smeared with an accusation of being tied to an international terrorist organization that's already on one of the government lists. So that's why this particular coalition has come together, and it will. Oh, go on.
Talk more about the origins of the bill, why Democrats supported the bill, and what it means now that it's going to the Senate, how organizations are organizing around it.
Right. So since October 7th, we've seen a whole bunch of outlandish anti-Palestinian pieces of legislation that have been designed to crush any protest or dissent around Palestine in the United States, while Congress, of course, continues to supply untold billions of dollars and weapons to Israel for its ongoing genocide in Gaza. This particular piece of legislation is the one that has gotten closest to becoming law. And initially, it did have significant bipartisan support because, of course, there anti-Palestinian racism is one of the great bipartisan unifiers in Congress. With the efforts of civil society groups to ring the alarm and educate members of Congress about the dangers of this bill, not only for Palestine advocacy, but broadly for any number of causes, and of course, with the election of Donald Trump, more and more Democrats have awoken to the danger. So right now, the important thing, now that the bill has passed the House, is to ensure that it does not go anywhere in the Senate. So it's extremely important for people to keep up the pressure on the Democratic members of Congress, and especially those in the Senate, to block this bill in the remainder of this session, and of course, if it comes up in a future legislative session.
And of course, next session. Now, this already came up just a week or two ago, and now it has passed in the House. The Democrats control the Senate, but the Republicans will soon control the Senate.
That's right, they will. But my understanding is that they'll still need 60 votes to pass. So I don't think the Republicans will have 60 senators. So there is still a chance that the bill can be blocked. But again, we can't take it for granted. It requires all hands on deck and as much pressure as possible on the Senate Democrats to ensure that this bill doesn't go anywhere.
You know, Daryl, it's interesting that I'm talking to you here in Baku, Azerbaijan, because there have been scores of journalists, civil society, climate justice activists arrested in the lead up to the COP. And for those who write about what's happening in this authoritarian petro state, they talk about the targeting of nonprofit groups. And that's the beginning of going after these people who end up in jail. A number have said they've been brutalized in jail. Your final thoughts, Daryl?
Yeah, so one thing that's important for people to understand is that the Supreme Court has already said that material support for terrorism can include speech acts. It can include so-called coordinated advocacy. So it goes far beyond funding. And this is something that I think for media organizations in particular should really be sort of raising the alarms in terms of the dangers of this bill for their work in particular.
Dara Lee, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Anthropologist, lawyer, legal scholar, teaching at the University of Chicago. We'll link to your article, The Most Dangerous Domestic Anti-Terrorism Bill Since the Patriot Act. Coming up, we'll look at Trump's new pick for Attorney General, Pam Bondi. Back in 20 seconds.
I grew up in the client state of a petrol king with a complicated take on things like human rights. But baby, that's the sacrifice bringing joy to the world. And I learned young how the West was won with Christ's big heart and a bigger gun. It wasn't enough, so we took the moon.
Old and youth. This breaking news, Britain has just said it would comply if Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or the former defense minister Yoav Gallant came to Britain in arresting him. Yes, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from Baku, Azerbaijan. But we end today's show looking at Donald Trump's new pick to head the Department of Justice, former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. Trump made the announcement hours after Matt Gaetz withdrew from consideration as Attorney General amidst a firestorm over allegations of sex trafficking involving a 17-year-old girl he had sex with. Pam Bondi served as Florida's Attorney General from 2011 to 2019. She served on Trump's defense team during his first impeachment trial, now works at the Trump-aligned America First Policy Institute. As a lobbyist, her clients have included Amazon, GM, Uber, and the Nation of Qatar. The news outlet Lever reports Bondi's brother, Brad Bondi, has represented Elon Musk and Tesla against federal securities fraud charges. We're joined from Rochester, New York, by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston, co-founder of DC Report, author of three books on Donald Trump, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. In that book, he details how Bondi dropped a probe into Trump University in 2013 after Trump's family Foundation donated $25,000 to her campaign. David, talk about her nomination and the significance of the Trump University case.
Well, in Pam Bondi, Donald Trump has just the person he really wants. Someone who will be a lapdog when it comes to wrongdoing by those people he likes and wants to insulate and protect, and a vicious attack dog for anybody Donald Trump wants to seek revenge against. And she demonstrated her loyalty to him 11 years ago when she accepted through an arm of her campaign, affiliate of her campaign for Attorney General of Florida, a $25,000 contribution from Trump University, a nonprofit, a charity. KPF. Charities in America are not allowed to give to political campaigns. Her campaign defended that they were going to keep that money. At the same time, there were complaints going from people in Florida that they'd been ripped off by Trump University, Donald Trump's fraudulent education scheme, and she killed that investigation. So the fact that Pam Bondi is corrupt and perfectly loyal to Trump has been thoroughly established.
So talk about what has taken place. I mean, she would be the head of the Department of Justice, what exactly that means. And again, she Her nomination follows the nomination of a fellow Floridian, right, Matt Gaetz, who increasing information was coming out on about this investigative report from the House, if you want to comment on that, and then more on who Pam Bondi is, how close she is to Trump, how, I guess you could say, bonded she is to Trump, and what would it mean to be the attorney general?
Well, Matt Gaetz, who practiced law long enough to have a cup of coffee, was a totally unfit candidate. And I believe Donald Trump put him forward as a test of loyalty and obedience by United States senators who are Republicans. He asked them to arrange what's called a recess appointment, which would have allowed Matt Gaetz to serve as attorney general for 2 years without the advice and consent of the Senate, which is required under the American Constitution. What he was really doing was finding out, will the U.S. senators bow down to him and ignore their constitutional duties to further his efforts to become our dictator, something, you know, I have warned about for 9 years. Now, in Bondi, he has someone who represented him on the floor of the House during his first impeachment, and I think to call her fumbling and not very good would be perfectly reasonable, arguably not competent. But that doesn't matter to Donald. What matters to Donald is total loyalty. If you want to create a dictatorship in the United States, there are two things Donald has to do to fulfill his statement that he's going to be dictator, though he claims for one day. You have to control the enforcement of the laws. And there are more than 100,000 people at the Justice Department. The FBI is under the Attorney General, for example. And then secondly, you have to fire those general officers, admirals and generals, who will not do your bidding and ignore their oath of office, and replace them with craven junior officers who will do your bidding, politicizing the American military. Those are the two key levers to creating a Trump dictatorship.
And finally, can you talk about her other positions and her position as chair of the equivalent of the Heritage Foundation, the America First group that has taken many positions like hers against same-sex marriage, against the Affordable Care Act, et cetera, David K. Johnston?
Well, Pam Bondi has been a lobbyist. She properly registered, unlike some people around Trump, representing Qatar and other foreign interests, as well as some domestic companies, including, I don't remember the exact name, sorry. But she has clearly identified herself with those people who want to take away freedom from Americans. The Republican Party used to say that it stood for freedom, for individual freedom. It's very clear that it now stands for authoritarian control. And the organization that she affiliated herself with is part of that. You will behave the way we want you to do in the Trump administration, or we will find ways to punish you. We'll find ways to take away money, to shut down your nonprofit organization on a whim, a mere accusation with no proof. And remember that under the U.S. Supreme Court's immunity decision, anything Donald Trump does in his official capacity is beyond review by anyone anywhere. The Supreme Court majority has effectively set up a dictatorship for Trump. The question is, does he have the competence to execute it? No. Does he have people around him who are competent to execute it? Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, co-founder of DC Report. Author of three books on Trump, including The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. I want to say thank you so much to our local crew here in Baku, Azerbaijan, Dave Pentlow, Julian Jones, David Yakalucci, Tobin Shackelford, Callum Skipworth, and Rufana Kamalova. A very happy birthday to Alexa Nemchik. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias, Sonji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. To see all of our coverage from COP29, go to democracynow.org and all the social media platforms. We're right there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.